Turn in your Bibles to Exodus 34. If you don't have one, put your hand up in the air. Exodus 34. It's sunny outside, people. Seriously, what in the world is going on? Absolutely beautiful. My name is John Mark. I'm one of the guys around here, and really excited to crack open the text with you and get to work. We are 3 weeks into a series called God Has a Name from Exodus 34, 6, and 7, which is God's self-disclosure statement in the scriptures. Because of that, it's the most quoted verse in the Bible by the Bible, meaning the biblical authors circle back to Exodus 34 all the time. Think of Psalm 103 in worship, right? Quote after quote, allusion after allusion, Exodus 34 is ground zero for theology of God. If you were not here the last few weeks, please go back and listen to the podcast. To recap, part one was on the name of God, how God has a name, meaning he is a person. By person, I don't mean a human. I mean that God is a relational being, not a force or a concept or an idea. And God wants to relate to you and me in the same way as to Moses, face to face as to a friend. Think of Moses' prayer, God, show me your glory. Or put another way, God, show me what you are like. And that really is the prayer, not only of this series, but of this church. God, show us your glory. God, show us what you are like. Then part two was on what in theology is called creational monotheism from last week. This idea that there is one creator God who spoke the universe into existence, but there is a multiplicity of created gods with a lowercase g, or real spiritual beings. Some are good, others are evil, and at war with the creator God. And you and I live right in the mix of that reality. Now, today, we get into the name of God. Remember that a name in the ancient Near East was way more than a label like George or Herbert, right? A name was a marker for your identity, or put another way, your character. Now we get into the character of God. Now let's start off by reading the text out loud. It's up here on the screens. Everybody, are you ready to get to work? I know it's your day off, but it's my work day. Let's work. Here we go. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Imagine living in 1500 BC in the Near East, out in the desert of what is modern day Saudi Arabia, at the foot of Mount Sinai. You live in a pre-modern, semi-primordial world that is filled with gods and goddesses, the majority of whom are not nice, if you know anything about ancient history. The gods were malicious and malevolent and mean-spirited to the core. Quite a few of the gods demanded child sacrifice. Think of the well-known story of the Battle of Troy, Brad Pitt, if nothing else, right? When Agamemnon is on with the army in the Aegean Sea on the way to the Trojan War, and he's the king of Greece, and Artemis, the goddess of the country of Greece, who's rooted in the city of Ephesus, is angry with the king and with the army, and the wind stops right in the middle of the Aegean Sea, and the goddess demands that he sacrifice his daughter, and he does so, and in the story, right after the sacrifice, the wind starts to blow. Myth or history? It's hard to tell, right? But that's the ancient world. If you're a Hebrew slave living over 1,000 years before Christ, you live in fear of the gods. But then along comes this God Yahweh, this God of your ancestors, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And this God is not like Molech or Artemis or Amun-Ra. Now, this God is set apart. For starters, he's the creator God, right? There's no equal. He's in a whole other category. But then on top of that, he's not capricious and finicky and hostile and mad at the world. No, this God is filled with, and at the top of the list, Right, number one, this God is compassionate and gracious in English, or rachum vachanun in Hebrew. Can you say rachum vachanun? That was all right, okay? Now, these two words are a pairing in Hebrew, meaning not only do they sound alike, rachum vachanun, but they are mutually illuminating, meaning they go together side by side almost always in the scriptures, and they kind of explain one another. The first word, compassionate, or rachum in Hebrew, can be translated merciful. In fact, the majority of the time in English, it's translated merciful. It's from the root word rachem, meaning female womb, literally. And it's the feeling of a mother towards a child. Here's a few examples of where the root word, female womb, right, or the feeling of a mother towards a child, is used in the scriptures. Psalm 103, as a father has what? Compassion on his children, so Yahweh has compassion on those who fear him. For he knows how we are formed and remembers that we are dust. Or here's one from Isaiah 49. Can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no, what? Compassion on the child she has born. Though she may forget, I will not forget you. I watch my wife with my three children in the middle of the night. If there's a cry from down the hallway, she is up out of bed in a nanosecond down the hall, right? I'm, babe, I got it. Really, I got it, right? Oh, she's amazing. Now, I'm not like that per se, but gosh, my kids turn my heart to butter. And I'm not, to be honest, I'm not really a kid person. I'm neat. But my kids turn my heart. I mean, seriously, yesterday I was working on my sermon and Moses, my four-year-old, who's right smack dab in the middle of Munchkin stage, right? And he comes up and says, you know, Dada, which is his name for me. I don't know. It's not Daddy. It's Dada. Daddy, will you wrestle with me? And W's and R's are really a problem. In fact, speaking is really a problem. But Dada, will you wrestle with me? And I said, no, I'm so sorry, but I'm behind. I'm working on my teaching. And then he goes, Dada, how about if I give you a kiss? Will you wrestle with me? Yes. Okay. Right now. Here we go. Right? Seriously, the way that a mother or a father feels towards a child is the way that Yahweh, the creator of the universe, feels toward those who feared him, which I'm guessing is you and me. If you walk with God, if you love God, that's the way that God feels toward you. God is compassionate. Now, rachum, or compassion, is a feeling word, right? It's the way a mother or a father feels. But wachanun, or gracious, on the other hand, is an action word. It's from the verb kahanan, meaning to show grace or to show favor. It's something you do. The verb is used in Genesis 33 in the story of Jacob and Esau. Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. They threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up, saw the women and children. Who are these with you? He asked. And Jacob answered, they are the children God has, notice, graciously given your children. Literally, it's the children God has graced your servant. The noun is used in Exodus, quote, if you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it by sunset because that cloak is the only covering your neighbor has. What else can they sleep in? When they cry out to me, I will hear, for I am what? Gracious. Interesting. Right here, gracious means give back the coat. Right? Don't take a loan with interest from the poor. Give back the coat. He's hungry, he's thirsty, he's cold, it's nighttime. Give back the coat, right? It's what happens after compassion, right? Gracious is something that you do. Compassionate is a feeling word. It's God's way of saying, listen, I feel for you. I care about you in the way of a mother or a father with a parent-like love. I feel for you and I'm moved to compassion. But gracious is an action word. I actually do stuff. I'm there. I actually help out when you pray, when you're in need, when you're cold at night. I give back the coat, I'm there. I'm compassionate and gracious. Now, with that background in mind, turn over to Jonah, to the right in the scriptures. Jonah is one of the prophets, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, and on, you potential parents, name galore, right? Now, I want, the roadmap is, I want each week to, after we kind of unpack the background of the language, as you know, we're going through Exodus 34 line by line, next time is slow to anger, week after that is abounding love and faithfulness. I want to look at one of the many places where Exodus 34, 6, and 7 is quoted in the Hebrew scriptures, and I want to look at where Yahweh is compassionate and gracious, because there is, in my opinion, a stereotype of Yahweh, at least in the Old Testament, as kind of mean-spirited and grumpy and a violent warmonger or whatever it might be. And I want to show you that, in fact, Yahweh is compassionate and gracious. Here's one example. You know the story, Jonah 1. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai, go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it because its wickedness has come up before me. Now, if you are new to kind of ancient history or the story of the Bible, Nineveh was the capital city of the Assyrian Empire, which starting right about the 8th or 9th century BC were the arch enemies of Israel, who oppressed Israel for decades with violence, with heavy taxes, and then in the end carried Israel away into exile in the north, the 10 tribes in the north, for the most part, never to return. And these are not nice people. The Ninevites are the stuff of legend. A while back, archaeologists unearthed a library at Nineveh, which is modern-day Iraq. Here are a few excerpts from the writings of the kings. Shalmaneser writes, "A pyramid of heads I reared in front of his city," his being a conquered king's city. "Their youths and their maidens I burnt up in the flames." Here's one from Sennacherib, you know about him from 2 Chronicles. "I cut their throats like lambs. I cut off their precious lives. As one cuts a string, like the many waters of a storm, I made the contents of their gullets and entrails run down upon the wide earth. Their hands I cut off." And listen to how they treated conquered leaders. Here's one of a conquered leader. Quote, "I flayed him. His skin I spread upon the wall of the city." Here's from another. "I pierced his chin with my keen hand dagger through his jaw. I passed a rope, put a dog chain upon him, and made him occupy a kennel." All that to say, if you're Jonah, you don't want to plant a church in Nineveh, right? You don't have a heart for the Ninevites. No, not at all, right? I mean, seriously, which is why, read 3, Jonah ran away, and notice, from Yahweh. Interesting, not from Nineveh. He ran away from Yahweh and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, went aboard, sailed for Tarshish to flee, to run from his life, from the Lord, or Yahweh in Hebrew. Interesting, Tarshish was in the exact opposite direction. Nineveh is to the east, or kind of the northeast in modern-day Iraq, right in the Tigris River. Tarshish is in the exact opposite direction to the west in modern-day Spain, and it was literally the last city on the map in the ancient world. Are you getting the picture? Go to Nineveh. Boo! Right? To Tarshish, right? Now, watch what happens. It's interesting because right here, you actually don't know why. Imagine reading the story of Jonah for the first time, okay? You actually don't know why. All you know is he is running, interesting, from Yahweh, but you don't know why. For the answer, you have to wait until the end of the story. Turn the page, chapter 3. Long story short, after a run-in with a fish and poetry, it's a long story. After the preaching of Nineveh, after the preaching of Jonah, the entire city of Nineveh repents. And read what happens. Jonah 3, let's start off in 6. "When Jonah's warning reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. This is the proclamation he issued in Nineveh. By the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let people or animals, herds or flocks, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink, but let people and animals be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent and, listen, with compassion, turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. This is the same guy. Think of the writings. This is the same guy who's skinning people alive. But right here, he repents at the preaching of Jonah, and he's praying for compassion. Now watch, 10. When God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he said, I don't care, and killed them anyway out of justice. No, not at all. He relented and did not bring on them the destruction he had threatened. Now, but to Jonah, this seemed very, what? My Bible says wrong. This seemed very wrong. What seemed very wrong? It's not a trick question. It's okay. What seemed very wrong? Yeah, God's compassion, not killing the Ninevites, seemed very wrong. And he became angry at who? At God. He prayed to Yahweh. Now listen, quote, isn't this what I said, Yahweh, when I was still at home? This is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew, and listen, here's the quote of Exodus 34. It's hilarious. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Yahweh, take away my life, you suicidal, for it's better for me to die than to live. Melodramatic, come on. But Yahweh replied, is it right for you to be angry? Which in Hebrew can be translated, you're an idiot, right? I mean, notice, here's Jonah, God. He's mad and he's angry at God because God is compassionate to the Ninevites, which makes sense. These are people who, raped and who murdered, who were violent and cruel and evil and barbaric. He's angry at God because God's compassionate. God, I knew you were compassionate and gracious. Dang it. I knew you were slow to anger, and he's mad at God. Interesting to me. You know, we all love that God is compassionate and gracious, but what about when God is compassionate and gracious to people you hate? We want to pick and choose, don't we? Compassion for him? Yep, no compassion for her. What about when God is compassionate and gracious to people who raped your children and murdered your wife and carried your family and friends off into slavery? What about when God is compassionate and gracious to Al-Qaeda terrorists who murdered your family? What about when God is compassionate and gracious to the man who abused you, to your ex-wife after adultery, to the boss who fired you without a cause, to so-and-so who lied about you, slander? What about then? What about when God is compassionate to him? What about when God is gracious to her? You know, a few years ago, by the grace of God, I've kind of only had a few really hard run-ins with people in my life, really two. And a few years ago, there was a guy who, in my opinion, wronged me. And we were not able to kind of see eye to eye. And that was really hard to work through for me. And what was harder was the fact that after that kind of breaking of relationship, God started to bless this guy. The audacity. It was really hard for me. God, he doesn't deserve blessing. Seriously. I deserve blessing. He doesn't. And guess what? God's not on my side. God's on his own side. You all know that, right? He's not on John Mark's side or America's side or your side. God's on his own side. And some people are for him and others are against him. And you know, I'm learning that you can't trust this God Yahweh because he just goes around blessing people. People who don't deserve blessing, people who don't play by the rules, people who aren't religious, people who aren't as good as you, people who don't pay taxes, people who don't tithe at church, which is most of you, people who, he just goes around blessing people right and left. I mean, he's scandalous in the fact that he is compassionate and gracious. Who is there in your life that if God were to bless, and maybe he is, if God were to bless you like Jonah, would get angry? You would get mad. It would be offensive to you. Is there a name right now? Is there a face? Is there somebody that you're going to see tomorrow morning or this afternoon? Or in the next week or month? Is there somebody you're locked in a relationship with? Is there a family member? Is there a ex-whatever? You fill in the blank. Who is there in your life that if God were to bless, you would get angry? I wonder what are the implications of the fact that you follow a God in Jesus who is compassionate and gracious. Now, on that note, turn over to Jesus. Turn to Luke. Let's keep going to the right. The roadmap for each week, I want to look at the text, kind of the language in Exodus 34 in Hebrew. Then I want to look at a quote of the passage in the Hebrew scriptures. And then I want to look at where that language is used of Jesus in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. For today, Luke, turn to Luke 17. I want to beat up on the caricature that is growing, sad to say, in part because of the rise of the new atheism movement, but not only because of that. I want to beat up on the caricature of Yahweh as the mean-spirited, angry warmonger in the Old Testament, and Jesus as the nice liberal hippie who went off to college and came home with all sorts of scandalous ideas about grace, you know? As if God the Father is mean and angry and wants to kill everybody, and Jesus comes home, no, Daddy, don't kill everybody, just kill me instead, and I'm awesome, and whatever, right? That I want to beat that caricature to a pulp. The reality is that Yahweh that you read about in the Hebrew scriptures, what you and I call the Old Testament, is compassionate and gracious, and Jesus is Lord, meaning Jesus is Yahweh, the creator of the universe, stepped into flesh and blood. Now let's read one example out of many. Luke 17, let's start off in 11. On his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. Interesting, Samaria is filled. This is a xenophobic, kind of filled with racial tension and bigotry time of history for Israel. And the Jews looked down upon the Samaritans because the Samaritans were kind of half-breeds, to put bluntly, were kind of Jewish and Gentile intermarried. And Jesus is right there on the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy, nasty disease, you're cut off from the temple, cut off from the people of God, met him. They stood at a distance and called out in a loud voice, "Jesus, Master, have pity on us." When he saw them, he said, "Go," and that word pity is eleo in Greek, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word vachanun. Okay? This is the language of compassionate and gracious used of Jesus. "Jesus, Master, have," my Bible says, "pity," or it can be translated "mercy on us." When he saw them, he said, "Go, show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. He was a Samaritan. And Jesus asked, "Where were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner?" Then he said to him, "Rise and go. Your faith has made you well." Turn the page, one more, Luke 18. Let's start off in 35. As Jesus approached Jericho, okay, now we're back in Jewish country, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David," which is a first century way of saying, "I believe that you are the Messiah, descendant from David, the long-awaited King of Israel, from God to put the world to rights, usher in the age to come." That's what he's saying, right? "Jesus, Son of David, have" what? Yes, eleos in Greek, or "mercy on me." Those who led the way rebuked him, said, "Shut up, quiet down." But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Notice, by the way, pause right there, how the man comes to God in prayer. "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." You know, there are two or three ways that people come to God in prayer. Some people come to God based on who they are, kind of who you are. "God, I'm a good person. Listen to my prayer." You know, or on the flip side, God, or they play the victim card. "God, you know me, my life is really hard and I'm the victim. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this suffering. I don't deserve this, whatever, you fill in the blank. God, answer my prayer." Other people come to God based on circumstances. "God, you know my circumstances. Look at my life. It's not fair, right? Seriously, look at what he has. Look at what she has. And I'm single, or I'm unemployed, or I'm not rich, or I'm not this, or I'm not that." And it's based on circumstances. But there's another way to come to God. It's what you see all over the scriptures, what you see right here with the blind man. And it's not based on who you are, and it's not based on your circumstances. It's based on who God is. And it's based on the fact that God is compassionate and gracious. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. There's no, hey, Jesus, I'm a victim. I was born blind. It's not fair. There's no, hey, Jesus, I'm a good person. I pray 10 times a day. Please, it's just, Jesus, have mercy on me. There's no, I deserve. There's no posturing. There's no elbow throwing. It's just, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. That's how you pray, my friends. That's how you come to God. You don't barter. You don't manipulate. You don't argue. You pray, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And watch what happens. Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. When he came near, Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? Shocking. Lord, I want to see, he replied. Jesus said to him, receive your sight. Your faith has healed you. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. Now, here's the point. I want you to see that in both stories, Jesus is compassionate, right? Meaning he's moved to pity or mercy. He's filled with feeling for the 10 lepers, for the blind man. He's compassionate, but also Jesus is gracious, meaning in both stories, Jesus actually does something. There's no spot where Jesus is there kind of crying with the man, I feel so sorry for you. I'm really sorry. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Right? No, Jesus actually does something. I'm not like that. Sometimes I get stirred up emotionally, but then I don't do anything. Am I alone in that? I mean, I think of the series on justice over Christmas a month or two ago. How many of you were stirred up by God's heart for the orphan, for the widow, for the poor, for justice in the world? How many of you, God spoke to you and called you to step into foster care or adoption or generosity or self-sacrifice of your comfort? What are you doing with that? What am I doing with that? Anything? Or was that a glorified pep talk called a sermon? Was that a moment? I mean, how many of you have that happen where you have a moment with God and you're stirred? And then a month later, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that, right? Or on the other hand, sometimes I do stuff. I work hard. I give money. I whatever. But it's out of duty and out of obligation. It's not from the heart. In the same way that sometimes, you know, when I say to my seven-year-old yesterday, Jude, go clean your room because it's a disaster, right? And I'm neat, okay? Jude, go clean your room. Okay, Dad. It's like the walk's always like, it's like the penguin walk down the hallway, right? Now, what is that? Is that obedience? Not really. But sometimes I'm like that with God. John Mark, here's what I'm calling you to do. Okay. You know? And seriously, it's like you do the right thing, but it's not from the heart. You know what I'm getting at? God is not like that. God's feeling and God's action are always in sync. Think of the name of God, Ehye in Hebrew, or I am that I am, or Yahweh, if you're speaking to God, He is. Remember that can be translated, what I am, I will be. Meaning God is marked by consistency through and through. God is gracious. How much of the time? Always. God is compassionate. How often? Always. 10 out of 10, 110% of the time. Meaning God is compassionate, moved to pity. God feels for you. God feels for me the way of a mother or a father to a child. But at the same time, out of that, God does stuff, which means when God is at work in your life, there's never a begrudging moment with God. Okay, I'm going to bless you. Because I have to. My son died on the cross. Okay. That never happens. God's feeling and God's action are always in sync. What about you? What about me? Next slide. Where are you stuck between compassion and grace? Between feeling and action? Between what God stirred up in your heart a month ago, a year ago, a decade ago, when you were in high school, what God stirred up in you and what you're actually doing? God is compassionate and gracious, and we see that in Jesus. Now, listen, Jesus isn't just doing this stuff because he's nice. That's kind of how we think of Jesus, right? As the first century version of Mr. Rogers, you know? Seriously. And don't get me wrong, I have no doubt that Jesus was nice, but there are times when Jesus gets angry, right? We're going to read about that in a few weeks. Slow to anger. There are times when Jesus gets mad. In fact, there are times when Jesus gets really mad. We're going to read about one in a few weeks. But for Jesus, this is about more than, hey, a disposition, a sweet disposition. I'm nice. For Jesus, this is rooted in his view of God the Father. Turn a few pages to the left to Luke 15. I want to read to you a story right before these two stories about Jesus filled with compassion for the blind men and for the 10 lepers. Right before those two stories, Jesus tells a story in Luke 15. In pop culture, it's called the story of the prodigal son, which is kind of off base, to be honest. There are two sons in the story, not one. And it's just as much, if not more so, about the older brother than the younger brother, because it's spoken to the Pharisees. It's a whole other sermon. But really, in my opinion, if anything, it should be called the story of the prodigal father, because it's about a scandalous dad. Now, short version, you know the story. There's a dad with two sons, and the younger son says to the father, I want my inheritance now, early, which in the ancient world was as good as saying, Dad, I wish you were dead. Seriously, come on and die already. And in an honor-shame society, which is foreign to you and me in the West, but well-known in the East, in an honor-shame society, that is the ultimate shame. Dad, I want my inheritance. I want you to die. The ultimate shame to the family name. And what's shocking is rather than banish the son to oblivion, the father says, okay, here's your inheritance. If that's what you want, okay. Here's your money. You know the story. The son goes off, moves to Southeast Portland, does a bunch of crazy stuff, right? And however long later, is out of money, which means he's out of sex, he's out of fun, he's out of women, he's out of friends, and he's all alone, and his life is a disaster. And there's a moment in the story where he says, I'm going back to my father, not as a son, but as a servant. And maybe if I'm lucky, my father will take me back into the house as a servant or as a slave. Now, watch what happens. Let's pick up right in the middle of the story, Luke 15, 20. So he got up, went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with what? Compassion. It's the exact same word. The father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son. Now, if you're a father in the first century, you don't run. That's undignified. You're a father, right? But he ran, seriously, to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, meaning the father cuts the son off right in the middle of the speech, quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Now, what I want you to see is that for Jesus, this is Jesus' view of God. Get that. To Jesus, God, the creator of the universe, is not a capricious, mean-spirited, angry tyrant in the sky, mad at the world and annoyed with you and waiting to strike you with lightning when you screw up. God does get angry to Jesus, absolutely. But to Jesus, at the core of God's being, he's a father who ran to his son, end quote. That's what God is like. To Jesus, God is compassionate and gracious, which is why, if you turn a few pages to the left, one more before we wrap up, to Luke 6, the beginning of Luke's gospel, is what's called the Sermon on the Mount. It's a compendium or collection of the central teachings of Jesus. The way Luke writes the Jesus story starts off by saying kind of, this is the kind of stuff that Jesus was teaching. And right in the middle of the well-known Sermon on the Mount, listen to what Jesus says, Luke 6:35. Love your enemies. Do good to them. Oh my gosh, wow. Lend to them without expecting to get anything back, your enemies. Then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High, a way of saying that God, Yahweh, is the creator over all the other gods, the Most High, right? Because he, Yahweh, is kind. That's what God is like. To who? To the ungrateful and the wicked. To Ninevites. To John Mark. To you. To the people you hate. To the face, to the name that you would be angry at God if he were to bless. He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. And then listen, right here is the hinge of the Sermon on the Mount, 36. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Now that right there is a landmark statement. Underline, star, highlight, whatever is your style. Make that note. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Jesus is saying that we are called to the imitation of God. And that's kind of standard rabbinic and Jewish worldview stuff, right? Kind of the goal of life is to imitate God. And Jesus stepped into that tradition. He's a rabbi in first century Israel, right? To Jesus, Exodus 34, 6 and 7, which is central in Jesus' worldview, it is not just about God. It's about you. And it's about me. It's about how you and I are called to live and be human in the world. God is compassionate, and because of that, we should be what? What? Compassionate. Thank you. God, that's me not being compassionate. I'm sorry. God is gracious. Therefore, we should be what? Gracious. God is slow to anger. Therefore, we should be hot-tempered. No, slow to anger. God is abounding, he's spilling over after the edge of the cup with love and faithfulness, and we should be abounding in what? Love and faithfulness. That's what God is like. I was reading Henry Nouwen a few days ago, and I was struck by a quote on Luke chapter 6. Read with me, or listen. Perhaps the most radical statement that Jesus ever made is, quote, be compassionate as your Father is compassionate, end quote. God's compassion is described by Jesus not simply to show me how willing God is to feel for me or to forgive my sins, but to invite me to become like God and to show the same compassion to others as he is showing to me. If the only meaning of the story were that people sin but God forgives, I could easily begin to think of my sins as a fine occasion for God to show me his forgiveness. There'd be no real challenge in such an interpretation. Listen, such sentimental romanticism is not the message of the Gospels. What I am called to make true is that whether I am the younger or the older son, I am the son of my compassionate Father. I am an heir. I am destined to step into my Father's place and offer to others the same compassion that he has offered me. Being in the Father's house requires that I make the Father's life my own and become transformed into his image. I want you to get more from today than sentimental romanticism in the language of Nouwen. I want you to get a vision of God and what God is like. He's not a God who's angry at you or mad or annoyed or ready to strike you. But he's a father. He's a mother towards you. But I also want you to get a vision of who you are and who you were made to be, who you are created to be. And as a follower of Jesus, what you are called to live out in the world. This is a text about God, Exodus 34, and this is a text about you and me. I think of Paul's language in his letter to the church in Colossae. He writes, as God's chosen people, which is a way of saying Israel, now made up of Jews and Gentiles like yours truly, holy and dearly loved. Who's he speaking to? Yeah, if you follow Jesus, you are dearly loved. And listen, clothe yourselves, and there's a list, but what's at the top of the list? Compassion. Paul's a Jewish rabbi. He's steeped in a worldview where Exodus 34 is at the center, at the top of Paul's list. Clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Gosh, I'm lousy at that. bear with each other and forgive one another. And Paul goes on. Meaning, in this, you get up every morning, and in theory, you put on clothing, I hope, for the sake of your roommate, right? You get up, you put on clothing, you put on your jeans and your shirt and your shoes and your socks. In the same way, Paul is saying, put on compassion every single day, 365 days a year. Get up, wake up, crawl out of bed in the morning, and put on compassion. Who is there that you're going to see tomorrow? Who is there that you live with? Who is there you get annoyed with, you get mad at? Patience is anything but a word that describes your relationship. What would it look like for you to follow Jesus, to imitate God, to be compassionate, to feel, to care about, and to be gracious, to actually do stuff, to actually help out? Here's a coat, here's money. Here's, I'm going to actually act on what God stirred in my heart. What would it look like for you tomorrow? Now, for some of you, this is literally a gift. And Paul's letter to the church in Rome in chapter 12, he writes about a gift of mercy. It's right there, the gift of prophecy, a gift of teaching, a gift of mercy. I do not have that gift at all. Thank you for disagreeing with me there. That was great. My wife does. I mean, if you know my wife, she opposites attract, right? My wife is incredible, and she is filled with mercy. I mean, she's literally, the way God made her, the way she's wired, I mean, her makeup, and then you put the Spirit of God in her, and she is, I mean, she is a walking empathy machine, right? I don't think I have an empathetic bone in my body. And I don't care. Get a job. Wait, did I say that out loud? Dang it. Right? I mean, I don't. I can be cold and impatient and calculated, not compassionate. I can be aloof and distant and self-absorbed, narcissistic, not gracious, other-centered, there to help out. And gosh, more than anybody with people that I'm close to, I can fake it kind of good with people that I'm not close to, but gosh, not with my wife. She knows better than anybody. I'm learning the hard way that she doesn't want fixing. She wants compassion. Husbands, are you learning that, right? Like, dude, I learned that like year one. I know it. I'm 11 years in. I'm just now learning it. When she comes to me and she's upset or mad or after a long day and she says, I want to talk with you, what she really means is I want you to listen to me, right? And she doesn't want fixing, right? She goes through her thing and I cut her off right in the middle. Okay, here's what you need to do. Boom, 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 boom. And you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. And if you'd only do this, and if you'd only do that, then boom, boom, boom. And really, it's all your fault, blah, blah, blah. You're not compassionate. I know, I'm sorry. I don't have that gift. right? I mean, it's funny, but it's not in the moment, right? It's like, no, you're a jerk. Stop, right? But it's funny, I'm learning that this kind of bent in me away from what God is like, compassionate and gracious. It's more than my personality. It's more that I'm whatever, type A or whatever. This is rooted in my view of God. At a subconscious level, and yeah, I know it's wrong because I read the scriptures, but at a subconscious level, I still think of God as angry. And God does get angry. But I think of that kind of at God's root. At a subconscious level, I think God is mad at me and disappointed with me and I'm not working hard enough and I'm not doing enough and I'm not whatever and come on, get with the program, Comer. And I know it's not right, but it's down there in my gut, underneath. This is about my theology of God. Think back to that quote of Tozer from the beginning of the series. We tend by a secret law of the soul to move toward our vision of God. What you think about God, how you understand your theology of God will define you, will shape you, will set the trajectory for your life. There's nothing more important, I would argue, than what you think about God. And the reality is that God, at the core of the Creator's being, the first thing at the top of the list, the God who spoke the universe into existence, the God who's over all the other gods, the God who's relational, wants to relate to you. You know what he's like? He's compassionate and he's gracious. Do you believe that? Do you actually, not here, but in your gut. Do I actually believe what God says? I'm compassionate and gracious. And does your life imitate that and mimic that and mirror that to the world? Do people look at your life, look at how you speak to your wife, John Mark, and see that's what God is like. God is compassionate and God is gracious. Let's pray.